Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Maura DeRoche, global innovator, visionary thought leader, and top-performing executive, plus general manager of Larig Skills, chairman of Career Planet, IFIP IP3 director, past president of the Computer Society of South Africa. Maura, you have a remarkable history of sustained success, contribution, and impact. We are indeed fortunate to have you do this interview with us. Thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
Well, thanks for according me the privilege.
Maura, can you describe how you got into computing?
Certainly. It was by accident, really. I wanted to be a journalist and went for an interview at one of the newspapers in Johannesburg. But I was too young to become a cadet reporter because they needed one to be a certain age. So they suggested that I worked for the newspaper anyway and then applied again in a year's time. As it happened, I went and worked in the accounts department quite closely with the computer department. And after working quite closely with them, they actually asked me to join the computer department, where I was first a computer operator and then a programmer, and the rest really is history. So it was an accidental thing. It wasn't something I envisioned while I was still at school.
Well, you have this remarkable history of success, so can you describe or discuss your prior roles and projects and the key lessons that you wish to pass on?
Yes, I think, first of all, looking at my roles at the Computer Society, I think that one of the reasons that I got involved in committees at Computer Society, first of all at chapter level, which is what we call our regions, and then nationally, is I truly believed that one has to be the change you want to see. So it's no good complaining from the outside, but that rather one should get totally involved and try and make change happen from the inside. And I think that you need to embrace all change and really see the positive. So that was a big lesson for me. The other thing that was a lesson for me in the same role was when I was elected president, I really for the first time got a true sense of how other people thought of me and how positively they thought of me. And I realized that was because whenever I interacted with a member, I did it on a person-to-person basis. And the lesson I got there is that nothing actually can replace the personal touch. And in these days where everything's electronic, quite often things are quite impersonal, but at the same time they give us such an opportunity to connect on the personal level. So I think that one must remember that we have to keep the personal touch there. Another key lesson, I think, in all my roles, and in fact the fact that I manage all the roles, is of course the importance of time management. I've also learned, again in all my roles, is to really trust one's intuition, because it's a marriage of all your experience combined with the gut feel. So it's not just gut feeling, but it's actually gut feeling informed by your experience. And then I think that the biggest lesson for me in my life, and it continues as a lesson, is that everything is a learning experience. And that one's got to see it that way, and then everything that ever happens to you, be it good or be it bad, gives you an opportunity to learn and grow.
So in your prior roles then, what were the three most difficult challenges that you were not able to overcome at the time, and then what would you do differently now?
Well, in one of our previous positions or my previous jobs, I had a manager who was almost abusive in the way that he treated people. He sort of blew hot and cold, but after the experience, when one looked back on it, one really saw how abusive it was, and it wasn't just in my own terms, but all of the people who worked for this particular person found that. And I think what I learned from that is that one shouldn't actually put up with those sort of abuses, but you should actually remove yourself from it. And I also learned from that one must never abuse power, that if you're a manager, you're in a position of great power and you're also in a position to do great harm, and that's what you shouldn't do. And so what I do differently now is remove myself from that. Another challenge I had at Larig Skills was taking over a business where all the key players had left, and I had to figure it all out for myself. I think that if I had to do that again, I would certainly delegate more. And in fact, delegation's always been a bit of a challenge for me. But I've learned that you have to trust people to do their jobs, but at the same time be realistic in one's expectations. I think I often expect people to be like me, perhaps, and that one's got to be more realistic and accept people for what they are.
You know, one of the things that comes up sometimes when I do interviews is this whole concept of unconscious bias. Do you feel that you experienced that, or do you have experiences with that?
Can you just explain what you mean by that?
Well, sometimes I think people may have a bias. They're not aware of it when you're dealing with them, and they can maybe project that attitude towards other people or to yourself or to the people around them. And sometimes it's a delicate area and you bring it to their attention, or perhaps sometimes you can't bring it to their attention. So it's a concept called unconscious bias, because they're not really aware of it, but they still have a bias.
Yes, I think so. And I think that again goes into power relationships, that people use that bias actually against somebody, possibly unconsciously, and not aware of why they actually have a bias. So yes, it is an issue.
You know, what were the key disruptive forces driving change in your life, and how can we learn from your experiences?
I think the very first one that I can think of is that my mother died when I was only 15, and subsequent events meant that I left home actually before even leaving high school. What that taught me, what could have been quite a desperate experience, actually taught me that I was a very strong person, and that I could, I was independent, and that I really could count on myself, as it were. And the big lesson there was that it's not what happens to you, but how you respond to what happens to you that molds who you are. Also, during the months, the final months under the manager I mentioned before, I had to really call on my inner strength. I had to really hold on to my ego, as it were, and I was very grateful for that core strength. So I think that everything that's happened to me, because I have an ability to turn it into a positive, has given me that core strength that no matter what happens, I always fall back on that particular strength. Stephen, I think it's perhaps also why I don't let gender biases affect me.
You know, you do a lot. You've got a lot of different kinds of roles that you play. So can you profile your different current roles and work and the value delivered to your diverse audiences?
Okay, for Lara Skills, to start with the company I work for, I really have a dual role in that I work with customers in rolling out learning solutions. I really work as a strategic account manager. And because I'm passionate about learning, I really go the extra mile to ensure that the learning works. So it's a true business partnership with my customers. At the same time, I manage the business and the small team of people and really try and encourage them to give of their best and most of all to get pleasure from their work. In the Computer Society as past president, my role is very much geared towards guiding the Executive Council on all matters. I've been on the Executive Council for a number of years, so I need to create the guidance and the continuity and try to be careful, especially around about governance. Obviously, my passion as well is professionalism, and I believe that as a society, the drive towards being truly acknowledged as a professional society is the most important thing that we can do. Career Planet, the charity that I'm on the board of directors for, indeed the chairman of the board, the person who runs this charity has all the enthusiasm, dedication, and passion of probably 10 people. But she's quite an inexperienced business person. So I really take on the role as a mentor and really to guide her as well around governance and what's the right thing to do and what's the wrong thing to do. I really have to temper her enthusiasm sometimes with reality. As far as the RP3 board goes, as you know, I've been on the task force since its inception. As my society wasn't able to make a financial contribution, I've provided marketing support on a pro bono basis, and I believe I've also been able to bring a developing country viewpoint to the mix, because the other certainly founder members were all from first world countries.
So, I guess let's explore this a little bit more detail then. IFIP is the International Federation for Information Processing. It's a UNESCO consultative body, and IP3 is their International Professional Practice Partnership Program, and that's where you served in both a sort of a marketing capacity and also providing the perspective from a developing country standpoint. And then you're the immediate past president of the Computer Society of South Africa, which is also a member of the International Federation for Information Processing, and really South Africa's official representative to the this UN-founded IFIP organization. And then you're general manager of Lyric Skills and the chairman of Career Planet. Does that kind of encapsulate those roles?
Yes, but just to correct you on one point, I'm not the official IFIP representative from the Computer Society South Africa. The official IFIP representative is Basie van Solms, who's the current IFIP president. I do go to IFIP General Assemblies because since Basie's been the president, he's asked me to sort of be his stand-in because he feels that he can't serve Computer Society South Africa's interests and at the same time serve properly as a president, but he still remains the official representative.
Right, and so the Computer Society of South Africa itself, the society is the official representative for South Africa to the IFIP organization.
That's correct, yes.
So in your current roles, what are the biggest challenges and their solutions, and how does this relate to business value?
Okay. Well, again, if I start with Lyric Skills, the challenge being in the e-learning business is always to try and change the mindset of people. It's a real issue because most people went to school and therefore they have a mindset that says to learn you need a teacher. So a lot of the challenge is around changing that mindset, and very often it's not the mindset of the learners that's the problem, but rather the mindset of the people who make the decisions that's the problem. So the solution really is to demonstrate why e-learning is the only way to provide lifelong learning. And you really have to be an evangelist and really believe in the solution. And the other thing is that providers such as ourselves really get involved in the rollout of the program in terms of help making sure that the program supports the business strategy. Whereas people who provide classroom or instructor-led training very rarely have that degree of business partnership with their customers. From the Computer Society point of view, the real challenge is getting things done with a largely volunteer organization. One has to accept that people have limited time and try to get a commitment to from each one of them to do only one or two things. And again, you have to manage expectations, and certainly in my case, I have to remember that not everyone is capable of getting as much done as I perhaps can. What I think we have to offer volunteers is an opportunity for growth that they don't necessarily get from their place of work. If they're just sort of one of a number at work, being on executive councils and chapter committees allows them to start working on developing their leadership skills. Career Planet, to develop the portal and the mobile units, the real challenge has been getting donor funds. That's been by far the challenge. And right now I'm trying to work on a franchise model which will help nationalize the concept and at the same time create a revenue stream. As far as IP3 goes and the task force, it's been very challenging dealing with a whole lot of people from around the world, often who have different worldviews. I think to overcome that, one has to listen empathetically, but also hold on to one's own sense of values. And I also had to realize that I shouldn't take things too personally, and really to just focus on delivering what's needed rather than worrying about the noise that goes on around the interaction.
You know, a key part of your background is actually this whole idea of professionalism in an IT, and people may not be aware what that means or why should we care. Can you talk more about that?
Certainly. People who work in IT always have to be highly skilled, and the knowledge that they have on entering the workplace doesn't last them for long. So continuous professional development is very, very important in IT. IT people work on projects that are worth huge sums of money, and yet we entrust them to work on these projects without them having demonstrating that they have the right skills, ethical commitment to the process and the outcome, etc. So what we need to do is make sure that IT professionals are committed to continuous professional development, are committed to ethics, are committed, have a commitment to the public and to the organizations in terms of outcomes. At the same time, I think that the individuals need to be recognized as having a status similar to those of accountants or lawyers or other professionals. So it's very much a two-way street. We want the people in IT to be more professional, and at the same time, we want them to be recognized as those professionals. It's very much been a fast-growth industry where the professional aspect has been lost along the way. So I believe that it's very important that IT professionals are seen as being such, but at the same time demonstrate that they should be seen as being professional.
So how are you contributing to professionalism in IT, and how can others do the same?
Well, as you know, I've devoted a lot of time to IFIP's RP3 program on a strictly voluntary basis, and I think that that speaks to my commitment as a professional to a process that I totally believe in. I'm also working with the Computer Society in South Africa and helping them to become ready for a professional accreditation. And my vision is to duplicate this in other African countries and also to help RP3 in the rest of the world's developing countries, in other words, those outside of Africa. So I believe that others can take on a similar leadership role to me, but in other developing countries. And really it starts from home. So you've got to first fix your own society and then try and duplicate that in other areas.
Maura, you have a long history in education and training. What role does e-learning play in continuing professional development?
Most people pay lip service to lifelong learning and continuous professional development. The reality is that you can't provide lifelong learning using only classroom training because nobody has the time or the money to accomplish this. So I believe that e-learning has a vital role to play in continuous professional development because it allows people to access training as and when it suits them to do it, and certainly allows them to access training on a lifelong basis. If one looks at the first RP3 accredited society, the Australian Computer Society, they offer the entire professional certification program online to a worldwide audience. This allows anybody anywhere to access the learning, and it's very good quality learning, and even allows societies such as Computer Society South Africa to make that training available to their own members. Now, I think that that's a good example because it stands to reason that that sort of learning would not be possible in Australia or in the world at large if it wasn't delivered by e-learning rather than instructor-led training.
Can you detail your work in supporting career planning and development for disadvantaged groups and why this matters?
A few years ago, a friend and colleague of mine was working with a not-for-profit, and I was invited to join them in a project where we visited several schools in disadvantaged areas with the purpose of trying to encourage them for careers in IT. What we found was that careers in IT were so out of reach for most of them that they just had never even entered their consciousness that it might be a possible career. We also realized that we could continue with projects like that, but that visiting a school once a year to give them a bit of career information really wasn't enough, that children needed to have access to quality career information so that they could get an idea of it and be able to go back to it over and over again and perhaps compare careers and decide which one they want. So what we, and that information should easily be accessible to them. And obviously, putting it on the web was a better option than trying to, for instance, print a guide, because no sooner have you printed the guide, and it's very expensive to do that, but the information is so quickly out of date. So we really believe that it's important because it gives everybody, no matter where they live, equal access to information about good careers and good professions that they could enter into and what learning they need to be able to enter that profession. We also have two mobile computer centers that travel to schools and community centers so that those children who are in disadvantaged areas where they don't have easy access to computers and therefore to the internet have a way of accessing the information when we visit with the mobile units.
You have a passion for women in IT. What does this mean and how can others get involved?
In an industry where there's a worldwide skill shortage, it's really unfortunate that so few women enter the profession. I'm involved with running the South African Computer Olympiad. It's one of the Computer Society South Africa projects. And we very rarely have any girls in the finals, and no girl has ever won it in South Africa. I was sad to hear that very few girls-only schools teach computer programs. Computer programming. And in fact, I'm working on a project to teach programming using e-learning so that everybody can have access to the curriculum. And the facility will be able to be used in South Africa or the rest of Africa or anywhere. The big challenge, obviously, is finding development funding for the initial work. I think it means that every woman should, especially women in IT, should try and take on a mentoring role for girls and for women who want to enter the profession. And as an IT community, we must acknowledge that women have a vital role to play in IT.
Can you talk about the enabling aspect of IT in developing countries and what this means to the world economy?
Yes. Most interventions in developing countries tend to look at the so-called digital divide and try and address digital literacy. Many of these initiatives fail because the funding requirements are huge and they don't have a direct effect on the economy. IT development, we all know, can be done from anywhere. So it can be a valuable export for any country. So I believe that if a country can develop an IT capacity, they have the potential to develop a product that can be exported. And IT is one of the few products, if you like, that can be created in one place and sold around the world because it's a technology-based product. So I believe that it's imperative for developing countries to develop IT people, then make sure that they're accredited to demonstrate that they're as good as anybody anywhere else in the world so that they don't get dismissed for being from a poorer country. And I really believe that that is a great enabler for developing countries. And once you improve the economy of a country, then addressing the digital divide becomes a much easier ask.
You know, where is South Africa positioned in terms of its economy versus the rest of the countries in Africa itself?
I heard somebody say the other day that South Africa is to Africa what America is to the world. So in the same way as the U.S. probably has about 30% of the world's GDP, South Africa has about 30% of Africa's GDP. So we are quite an economic powerhouse, and we're not nearly the biggest country population-wise. So we are quite an economic powerhouse and have quite well-developed infrastructure and so on. But we're very much a bit of a dichotomy because we have some very, very developed country aspects but some very real developing country aspects. And sometimes the two clash and that is a disabler rather than an enabler often.
So with the economic challenges worldwide, how can we improve the ability of companies to survive?
Many prominent business people around the world are saying how important it is for companies to develop their own people. I think this is about upskilling staff, but also empowering them to contribute to the overall success of the company. We've got to learn to encourage creativity, intuition, leadership, and quite often, those are the things that we don't do. So I think that we really need to make sure that we've got good people whose contributions are acknowledged. so that we really do encourage creativity, innovation, and so on.
What are the most important broader business challenges and solutions?
Okay, I think that quite a few examples in past years around the issue of the lack of corporate governance tell us that corporate governance is a very big business challenge, and really we must adhere to the codes and so on that are input, and it should be an adherence to the spirit of the code rather than just ticking boxes. Social networking. I think that social networking will be an opportunity missed by many companies who don't allow their workforce to access it. But they should. Everybody in business should find ways to leverage social networking. So rather than prohibiting it, they should embrace it and really find ways that it improves the ability to do business, the ability to communicate with the employees. I think business and workforce agility is a challenge because it changes the way that we have to manage people and manage our businesses. But we have to be open to different ways of people working, etc. I think that what the internet brings us is a mind shift change from ownership to access. So instead of looking to own physical things, if I look at ebooks as an example, instead of looking to own the actual book, you need to be excited about the fact that you can access many more books than only one book. So I think that that's a challenge, but at the same time, it can really provide us with a lot more resources. And then finally, I think green issues. I think that the whole global warming, etc., is really something that businesses are challenged with continually, and that they have to find real solutions to.
You know, you have this, as I mentioned, that remarkable history of success, and you've been a leader for, quite some time, and really being at the forefront of technology and of business. From that position, can you provide your predictions of future trends and their implications and opportunities?
I think that more and more social networking will be used as a business, and more importantly, as a learning tool. So I think that will be very much a big trend. I think truly mobile workforces will start to become much more of a reality. And what that will do for companies is allow them to have access to the very best skills, irrespective of where the person is placed. So I really see that the trends will be around agility, around really using technology to make our businesses better, to give us more opportunities, and to really embrace technology rather than just using it as a tool.
So, we have a lot of people in the audience who have a business background and a technology background. And again, based on your experiences, what would you say would be your top recommended resources, and then why?
Okay, I think that e-learning resources, which give you access to a whole lot of a wide variety of learning materials, and that's paid for e-learning as well as many of the free-to-use resources. I mean, the Open University in the United Kingdom, for instance, has some excellent learning opportunities that are free to use. So I think that the wealth of material that's available to us gives us a real opportunity for continuous professional development without spending money or without having to wait on an individual level, having to wait for our companies to spend money. And then the other thing is online books, having instant access to a whole wealth of information, trusted information, published books, summary reports. And what that does for me is it improves my productivity, but at the same time allows me much, much better quality of work. So I think that online resources in terms of learning, in terms of reference materials, are the resources that and then in addition to that, tools like virtual meeting tools or social networking tools that really allow us to work with people wherever they are. I think that those are fantastic resources to use.
You know, you are so engaged with different kinds of societies and groups. I'm not sure, but you're likely a member of the Association of Community Machinery. You're a leader within the Computer Society of South Africa. You're a leader within the IFIP IP3 project and many, many other programs. So would you recommend joining these community organizations in some way?
Definitely. They give you a great opportunity to network with other people. And also, using the ACM, and yes, I am a member, as a good example, they give you access to a lot of resources, learning resources, reference resources, etc. But it also allows one to understand that you are part of a global community, that there are people that you can reach out to in all the corners of the world. And I think part of being a professional is part of being a worldwide community of people, that you're not just an individual in a company, but rather part of a much, much larger thing that you have access to. The ACM, while we were on the subject of them, have been fantastic in terms of having a membership option for professionals from developing countries at a really, really low rate. So they've made it accessible truly to people in developing countries to a much greater extent than any other body that I know of.
Again, you know, you travel a lot. You've been involved in computing for some time in senior roles, and you've come in contact with a variety of different kinds of individuals from around the world. You must have some really interesting stories to tell. Can you share a few of them?
You know, this was the hardest thing to get my head around, because I've probably got thousands of funny stories, but when you try and think up one, it's quite, or two or three, it's not so very easy to do. But I'll tell you one little amusing tale that came to mind, and it's one right in my back door. I've mentioned the work I do with providing career information to young children. When we were at one of the schools, one of my colleagues pointed at one little girl in the audience and said to her, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And she said, "I want to be a checkout assistant at a supermarket." And we sort of, we were telling her about this fantastic career she could have in ICT, and all she had in her mind was that she could maybe be a checkout assistant at a sort of Walmart. And we realized that was because her worldview was so small, that probably her mother had that kind of profession. And whilst it was quite amusing, it was also quite quite sad and quite surprising. I think one of the amazing things that I need, you know, if I think about being amazed, is the amazing amount of work that the IP3 group, the IFIP Task Force has achieved in a relatively short period of time, that a group of people from around the world could actually get as much done as they have. And I think that sometimes they're not conscious of how much they've got done. But given that they're from the four corners, I think that's quite an amazing thing that I'm very, very privileged to have been part of.
So can you summarize again what the United Nations-founded International Federation for Information Processing, or IFIP, is trying to do with this professional practice partnership program?
We're really trying, the whole idea behind it is to create a global profession in IT. So IFIP realized that there was a great need to create a professional status for IT, and that the opportunity was there to do it on a global basis. So they created IP3 as a means of creating and accrediting a global profession, so that not only are you saying, well, yeah, the requirements for a global profession, but indeed this is how you create and accredit and acknowledge a global profession, but have a standard that is a global standard, but that is locally applied, so that each society can actually have their own professional standard, but that it meets the requirements of the global standard.
I see. So what you're saying then is professionalism in IT basically involves initial education, skills development leading to some kind of certification, and that certification often combines with it this idea of continuing to demonstrate professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, adherence to best practices and common standards. But there's a local image of that, and that's all under this umbrella of global standards, which is really managed by IP3.
That's correct. That IP3 will manage and measure, if you like, the global standard and make sure that as it's applied at local level, it still meets the global standard, even though it might have its own flavor depending on local requirements.
And I guess that there's a historical inflection point in that never before in the world has this ever occurred. And, you know, where you have a broad community supporting this idea of professionalism in IT and making IT a true profession on a global basis.
That's right. It is a historical moment for all of us. I think, too, that there's no true global profession. If one looks at the professions as we know, the medicine, accounting, law, you can't, as a lawyer who's qualified in South Africa, just go and work in the United States, because you need to almost requalify. Maybe it's a slightly shorter process, but you still have to requalify. So what we're doing or trying to do is indeed unique, because we're going to create a global profession that as soon as you've got you're accredited as an IP3 professional, you can say, well, I'm an IP3 professional in South Africa, but I can also be an IP3 professional in the United States or in Europe, because it will be the same. And so I think that we go beyond just being the first people to create a global IT profession, but in fact the first discipline to actually create a truly global profession.
And it launched this year?
It launched this year, yes. The Australian Computer Society, in fact, the Australian Computer Society were accredited late last year, so they would have awarded their first IP3 professionals early this year. And the Canadian Information Processing Society, KIPS, has just awarded their first group of professionals as IP3 professionals.
So it's a remarkable achievement, and it speaks to the tremendous work that you and your colleagues have done who were sort of initial components of this and leaders on the IFIP IP3 task force.
Yes, definitely.
Now, you know, this is when I sort of turn it around, and we're near the end of the interview, and so I say to you, Maura, you're doing the interview. What kind of questions would you ask? And then, of course, you have to answer them, too.
Okay. Well, this was also quite a challenging part. I think that the first question I might ask is, how would you like to be remembered when you die? Because I think we all wonder what our obituaries would look like. And I think that I would like to have been acknowledged as making a difference to those whose lives I've touched, and very much for my adherence and strong belief in ethics and values, because those are the principles that I live by. Another question that I might have asked myself is, what would you do differently if you had your life over? And my answer to that is, I would definitely have got a better education in my earlier years. And I also am sad that I haven't managed yet to live and work in another country. I love traveling, but I haven't had the opportunity to work in another country. So that's something that I'd do differently if I had my life over. And then I might ask, who are the people that are my heroes and who are the people that I look up to? And I must say that in answer, that I've been fortunate to work with many people who've been great mentors and who've taught me a huge amount. And often the managers that I've had have taught me a huge amount, have been people that I've looked up to. I've also always greatly admired Greg Priest, the former CEO of SmartForce, who's truly a visionary, and especially around learning. So I've always admired him. Our very own South African Nelson Mandela, who's an absolute ideal of leadership, and I think we all aspire to have his leadership qualities and his forgiving nature, because he's demonstrated that more than I think anybody else has. And then possibly someone like Oprah Winfrey, not because of who she is, but that she's the living embodiment of the fact that you can be anything you want to be. It doesn't matter how you start off your life. So I think that those would be my three questions.
So of those people that you've indicated that you very much admire, have you met any of them?
Yes, I've only met Greg Priest, because because I used to work for the company. I haven't had the opportunity to meet Nelson Mandela, sadly, and also not Oprah Winfrey. But both of those individuals are larger than life, so one always feels that even though you haven't been able to physically shake their hands, you sort of, you invite them into your homes from time to time, so you do know them. But I would be truly honored to meet Nelson Mandela. I would also be truly honored to meet somebody like Bill Gates, who I think is also an amazing person.
Well, Maura, you know, we're very fortunate that you came in today to do this interview, and we will continue to follow your significant global and historical contributions. And we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
Thanks to you too, Stephen, for the time.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Maura DeRoche, global innovator, visionary thought leader, top-performing executive, general manager of Lyric Skills, chairman of Career Planet, IFIP IP3 director, and past president of the Computer Society of South Africa.